Actually, I didn't do my residency at the University of Washington. I was a New Havenite, so I'm really not an inbred Seattle person, even though some people think I am. I also have to tell you that I'm really, really delighted to be doing this, but I was sort of conscripted into this assignment. I was sailing in January in a completely remote area of the Caribbean. I had no email access, and about halfway through, I actually did sort of get my BlackBerry to work, which was a really bad thing. And there are probably about 20 emails about this session, and all of a sudden I was assigned to review the research topics at the session. So I thought, you know, you had seen enough of me. I had been up here several times. You really didn't need to hear from me. So I made some weak protests, but obviously I was not successful. So you're stuck with me for the next 10 minutes. Just some caveats about what I'm going to talk about. Obviously, I wanted this to be very brief. I was aiming for 10 minutes, and I only have 7 slides, so I think that should work. That means I really can't go through all the topics that I think are worthy of discussion. This was a very rich conference, and I did want to focus on research presented at this conference. Obviously, there are a lot of topics that weren't delved into in depth here, and I don't really want or have time to go over those. And what I tried to do was to look at what was either surprising, consistent, or new at this conference. Also think a little bit about what was missing, what didn't we hear about that maybe could inform what we do for the conference in Atlanta 2 years from now. So that's sort of the framework that I used. This is necessarily, because of those factors, a very selective set of concerns and questions. It's also idiosyncratic. I couldn't go to all of the sessions. I couldn't clone myself. You're probably happy about that. Even though I would have liked to have heard a lot of the sessions, and it's also informed a little bit by my own interests and what I'm most familiar with. So I apologize in advance if I don't talk about what you think is most important, and I'd be actually interested to hear if there are areas that I did not mention subsequently. I posed this not so much as a content review of the sessions. I think everybody, attendance at the sessions was great. There was a lot of information available and imparted, but I really didn't want to do this as kind of what were the highlights of the conference. Really more, I wanted to use the contents of the conference to drive what I thought were possibly provocative questions, I hope, and questions that maybe might challenge you as you go out to think about translating research into practice and then honing into the research as it informs practice. I will be citing selective supportive abstracts. It's not an exhaustive review of the abstracts, so if you had an abstract on a topic I mentioned and your name's not on the slide, please don't be insulted or upset. It's just the way it is. And then finally, I'll be succeeded by Will Wong, who's going to give the program perspective, but I have to say that even though I don't run a program, many of my best friends run programs, and I really feel like the distinction between research and program needs to be thought about carefully and ideally broken down a little bit more than it is. There's so many things that we do that directly inform practice, and I really would like to think more about how we can sort of answer questions that will make practice more efficient and provide better care to patients using some of the research methodologies that researchers are familiar with. So I think it's a little bit of an artificial distinction, and you'll see that I do stray into program territory in some of my questions. So hopefully that will not be too upset with me. So I broke these down into several areas. There's a lot of material on the slide, so try not to read down. I'll take you through it. And epidemiology, prevention, basic science, et cetera. And so I'll start with what I think are the hot topics in epidemiology of STDs. This is the only slide on epidemiology. I think that everybody is very, very interested in trying to figure out what is really going on with trends in chlamydia positivity slash prevalence in the United States in women, and why are we certainly seeing, if not inclines, at the very minimum stabilization of these rates. For those of you who are lab people, you'll know that TNTC means too numerous to count, if you're counting polys on a slide, and there really were a lot of abstracts on this topic, so I didn't really want to cite them all. I think from a research perspective, there are a number of possible explanations for this. Are we not screening women in the right groups? Are we screening in the wrong groups? Are we not realizing potential of self-collection strategies for women? Are we not focusing on males? Or is this part and parcel of the immune hypothesis that Bob Brunham has put forward, namely that the more that we screen women, the more that we essentially interrupt the natural history of this infection and prevent women from developing protective antibodies in the future, so they're more vulnerable to reinfection. session. I would also add that Bill Miller at ISSTDR last summer did a beautiful presentation where he actually looked at the case mix of people, women who are screened, and how if you just make small shifts in the age and the likelihood of positivity of the screened population, you can actually impact quote-unquote trends quite impressively, and that's not surprising. And I don't think that we really have defined the case mix for many of the populations we screen. It relates to this idea of coverage and really who is getting screened. So there's no question that this area is very, very rich for epidemiologic research and also health services research, and I think it's going to be a really, really important thing to continue to try to tease out in the next couple of years. I think the second area that you would have had to be really asleep at the wheel not to find fascinating is the dynamic shifts in syphilis epidemiology that are occurring in the United States and the relationship to really amazing and interesting sexual network findings. So I've listed a couple of abstracts here. The McGoy paper actually discussed very interesting increases in primary and secondary syphilis in Tennessee, 90% increases among black women. The Salmon abstract was very interesting and reported 9 congenital cases of syphilis in Philadelphia, up from 0 in the previous years. The Urquidy paper, fascinating poster, actually discussing an outbreak in the Tohono O'odham tribe in Arizona. And then in contrast to that, you've got Jeff Klausner's poster discussing the successful interventions to affect declines in primary and in early syphilis in San Francisco, primarily among MSM. So in thinking about this, I don't know how many of you saw the Homer watercolors last night and those incredible seascapes with all the water swirling around and the different currents. And I mean, to me, syphilis epidemiology is really like this. There's tons of things going on. There are these little networks with really complicated epidemiology. And I think trying to track what's really happening in the context of local sexual networks is really, really going to be a major epidemiologic challenge and a very rich exercise. And then the last thing I would say about epidemiology, again, is this is very selective. I could say a lot more, but just to choose the highlights, is there were not that many abstracts on trichomoniasis this year. There were a couple, however, that continue to remind us that this STD is incredibly prevalent. Bobby Vanderpool, who's been a leader in this area, showed, I think, very convincingly that among sex workers in Indiana, prevalence was very, very high. There was also a poster by Mamou and colleagues that showed a 13% prevalence using the Aptima test in a public health clinic situation. And then there were a number of abstracts basically confirming that nucleic acid amplification approaches for trichomoniasis are obviously more sensitive than our previous methods. I have to say, when I speak to providers, and I do a lot of teaching and a lot of training, and I ask providers how many of them know that there's a pretty decent, a very decent, and a reasonably affordable point-of-care test for trichomoniasis, I would say on average 1 to 5% of the people in the room even know that that test is available. So awareness for trichomoniasis burden and diagnostic potential, and really its sort of meaning as an STD, is incredibly limited, and I think that that's something that really needs to be sort of built up as a research topic. What about prevention? There was a fascinating mini plenary yesterday at which Sue Blank, Connie Callum, Peter Leone, and Sammy Gottlieb discussed HSV-HIV interactions. And the big question on everybody's mind for the last couple of months has been, do we now have 2 intervention studies showing that HSV suppression of HIV-negative people does not prevent them or help them from acquire HIV? This was a very interesting session, and I think in terms of the immunobiology of why that intervention didn't work, it's going to be a major focus in the next year, because we're still left with incredibly convincing and robust data to say that there is a major relationship between HIV and HSV2. There's no question. It's just suppressing HIV-negative people does not really seem to protect them, and we really don't understand why. There was also a lot of discussion about how we use tools to detect HIV. What is the role of type-specific serology? should all STD clinics be screening? And again, I'm getting kind of into the program arena, but it's a major research question to ask, what do people do after they get a seropositive result for HSV2? Is that really going to affect patients' behavior enough to modify the outcomes associated with their prevalent HSV infection? And there was some very serious discussion from the audience about why we aren't doing more to sort of let people know about the burden of HSV2, specifically when it affects racial minorities, specifically women, so dramatically. 61% HSV2 seroprevalence in New York City, black women in New York City in the NHANES subpopulation seroprevalence. So really very rich area, and I could go on about that for a long time, but there's a lot to say and do about that. There are a lot of other STD-HIV interactions that were kind of addressed at this conference, but I have to say I was a little disappointed at the lack of numbers, really. There were relatively few abstracts, I would say, that discussed this. And I'm going to talk about that as we move into clinical management in a second. There were a lot of abstracts on harnessing the internet to control as well as to facilitate STD spread. For those of you who were at Will Wong's late breaker presentation yesterday, it was pretty riveting, I have to say. It was like going to a movie, and only a movie only people like us would like, actually, though. It was really fascinating, and then there were several other abstracts that sort of talked about the internet as an amazing facilitator and a synergistic sort of potentiator of STD spread and outbreaks. However, on the flip side, there were some very lovely abstracts about using the internet as a positive force in STD control. The entire session B3 was devoted to that. Charlotte Gatos has been doing some pioneering work for a long time, offering testing over the internet, as was highlighted yesterday in her receipt of the ASTDA Achievement Award. And then Elman and colleagues did a very nice report of an internet-based partner notification strategy that other cities have been using for a long time, or at least sort of getting up and running. So I think research in that area is really interdisciplinary, very interesting, and clearly the way that we have to go if we want to address situations like Will communicated to us yesterday. This topic, again, kind of idiosyncratic but near and dear to my heart, is several abstracts that I think brought out this question about when we will get serious about studying and integrating or implementing integrative preventive health care for women, namely contraceptive care. To me, integration of contraception, STD care, and HIV testing, also hepatitis and TB, Kevin's really very close to his heart as well, but to me, the whole issue of contraceptive care is incredibly important for our young female clients, and I think more research about the operational sort of aspects of that are really, really critical. There was a very nice symposium, which unfortunately I could not get to, about how California is approaching this, particularly in adolescents. The Handle abstract, I thought, was really interesting because they actually showed very low rates of chlamydia screening among young women presenting for emergency contraception in New York City, but a very high yield, 12% prevalence among the women who were screened. And then Susan Phillips' presentation actually discussed San Francisco's pilot project to provide emergency contraception through an online access point without requirement for exam. So a number of really innovative strategies emphasizing availability of emergency contraception, but also the fact that this population, you know, is really important in terms of missed opportunities to provide STD diagnostic testing and education about STDs. And then finally, I could really talk a lot about, but I won't, the wonderful sessions on monitoring the impact of HPV vaccines. Many, many really excellent people who've been involved in this effort for a long time, looking at issues around surveillance of not just HPV infection, but the consequences of HPV infection in women, of course, but as we think about rolling the vaccine out to men in that group as well. So really critical, critical area. I'm a little wary of getting into behavioral science and modeling, but obviously, since I was given the charge, I will go there. These are just some of the many things. There were wonderful abstracts, I think, in this category. A huge topic given the static, if not increasing, incidence of HIV among men who have sex in the United States is how can we reverse the trends in risky sexual behavior among HIV-positive people and some men who have sex with men. There were some very interesting abstracts that continue to speak to enhancing efforts to detect asymptomatic STD, to look for STDs, particularly in the setting of acute HIV infection, and to better affect partner management of people with HIV who develop STDs. Really critical, and hopefully the guidance that CDC recently released will be critical to that. The TIE abstract was important, I think, because it showed relatively low rates of self-reported syphilis and gonorrhea testing among MSM by self-report using data from the National HIV Behavioral Surveillance System. The Helms study actually did report that men who report sex with other men and who went to STD clinics are increasingly being tested for HIV, which is very good. They've got a high cumulative rate of HIV testing. But then the Chien abstract was disturbing because they looked at acute HIV infection in Los Angeles and found, again, a very disturbing high rate of STD co-infection. So some abstracts, but I think not enough about this really horrific synergy that continues to occur, and that I think we are really not doing enough to probably intervene at point of care in the settings that we really need to be addressing. There were some really interesting abstracts about the emerging appreciation, I think, for the inadequacy of sexual orientation as a categorical descriptive. I look at sexual orientation, sexual identity, the way that I do look at race. It's really not adequate to characterize people as black or white. It's really not adequate to characterize people as gay or straight. It's really a spectrum, and behavior is so much more complex than those labels, and yet we use them all the time and continue to use them and continue to make assumptions, and if you listen to Frank Gilliam, have our frames about people based on those inadequate descriptors. The Patella abstract and the Lindley abstract were similar in that they looked at nice population-based assessments of sexual behavior and sexual risk behavior by identity and by actual behavior. And both of those abstracts showed that bisexual men and women, in particular in the Patella abstracts, it was adolescents in high school, that bisexual behavior was associated with significantly higher rates of risky behavior. And these were self-reported by young people in both of these things. The Lindley abstract was in college students. Devika Singh actually presented an interesting abstract based on the IPP data that showed that women who reported sex with other women in Region 10 had higher rates of chlamydial infection if you look at the last 3 years in that project. So again, time for us to really get beyond some of these labels that I think are crippling our ability to really define risky behaviors by more complicated parameters. There were really not any abstracts about mathematical modeling. I know that hasn't been a thing at this meeting, but I actually think that for program interventions or for translational research, this could be an incredibly rich area for this group to at least start to hear about, start to get excited about, and start to understand. I know my eyes crossed originally when I thought about mathematical modeling. It made me not a mathematical kind of person, really, in some ways. But it really is fascinating, and I think it really should start to define research priorities. And then I just can't end without offering up what I thought was the best abstract title: When There's Nothing to Do, You Do Somebody, Environmental Factors Affecting HIV Risk in Rural North Carolina. I actually went to this talk this morning. It was really excellent, but I want to congratulate you for a gripping title that got me to stay, actually. So just finishing up, I think I just have two more slides. What about clinical science? We continued to hear about antimicrobial resistance, and of course, the most evident antimicrobial resistance problem that we're dealing with is quinolone-resistant Neisseria gonorrhea. So I don't know when we're going to lose cephalosporins. Hopefully we won't for a long time, but that's obviously an area that we need to continue to focus on, track, and be very concerned about. Fascinating, I think, results from Ned Hook on his syphilis treatment trial, where people were randomized to penicillin or azithromycin yesterday and showed essentially equivalent cure rates for early syphilis in these people, which was really very welcome and interesting. On the other hand, the San Francisco group in the CATS paper continues to show increasing rates of the 23S ribosomal RNA mutation in the isolates of Treponema pallidum that that group recovered from patients in San Francisco who presented with Shankar's. In fact, I think in 2006, 77% or so had this mutation. So we're really left with a great question of how do you translate research into practice. We've got this study showing really lovely effects of azithromycin, certainly better than getting a shot in your butt, even though it does make people a little sick to their stomach. I still would opt for that. Worked very well in this study, but really molecular concern in terms of the emerging epidemiology of this infection. So I think a huge challenge, an interesting area of research. And then again, another topic that is sort of near and dear to my heart is really STD-related syndromes. Can we use new molecular tools to identify new etiologic agents? Joan Chow presented a very interesting paper looking at PID diagnoses in California and showed that a small minority of PID cases, even in young women at high risk for chlamydial infection, actually had a positive chlamydia test. I mean, really, that's partly a problem with the non-specificity of PID, but it's also a problem with the fact that we are looking at microbial communities that cause these syndromes that are not defined by our current diagnostic tests. Kate Wetmore also presented a paper looking at urethritis in men enrolled in a randomized controlled trial for treatment of non-gonococcal urethritis, and she also showed that the minority of urethritis cases in these men actually had a definable molecular etiology, either chlamydia, gonorrhea, mycoplasma genitalium, ureaplasma, urealyticum. So what is causing these syndromes? What causes the most of cervicitis that isn't associated with these bugs? What causes most of urethritis? We really don't know, and I think applying these new cultivation-independent tools to these syndromes is really critical. I think the next part of that is trying to understand what the role of the bug versus the role of the host is in inflammatory STD syndromes. We know that not all women who get chlamydia get cervicitis. The majority of them don't. What defines who gets these really inflammatory syndromes and who doesn't? Lisa Manhart presented a very interesting paper looking at women with mycoplasma genitalium at the cervix and showed that older women with that infection were more likely to have cervical inflammation or cervicitis than younger women. Very surprising finding that makes you question what is going on with these older women. Why are they reacting to this bug differently? So a whole world, I think, of very exciting times, both in terms of the immunology and the molecular biology. And then this is my last slide, really mostly meant to just, again, provoke you into thinking about this. I know this is not a traditional basic science, i.e. laboratory-based meeting, but there are a couple of trends I just think you should be aware of. We still don't really have a broadly active vaccine candidate against HSV2. You could say that for a lot of STDs, chlamydia, gonorrhea, certainly. But HSV2, I think, has been particularly frustrating, and it would be very nice if we could move a little bit more in that direction. And then just to sort of throw this out there, there's a whole movement. I sort of did an overview of microbicides for Polly Harrison the other day. There's a whole movement in the pre-exposure prophylaxis field. We're all familiar with PEP or post-exposure prophylaxis for HIV. So you get a needle stick or you have unsafe sex and you can have PEP with antiretroviral therapy. The PrEP field really is pre-exposure prophylaxis and grew out of developments like microbicides. So could women use microbicide gels to protect themselves from HIV and STD? And I can tell you what's happening is that the field is moving into selection of specific antiretroviral agents for PrEP. That means that people are looking at tenofovir vaginal gel, which is an anti-HIV, tenofovir rectally for HIV prophylaxis in HIV uninfected people, and other compounds that are coming up that may be incorporated into vaginal rings, they may be incorporated into all kinds of devices. And I think this is incredibly exciting, but I have really two concerns. One everybody has, and one is a little bit my own STD kind of bias. Everybody's concern is that the widespread use of these agents is going to promote resistance of HIV among people who are infected while they are using them. And I think that makes sense, and that's sort of a big virologic issue. But I sort of feel like the other thing that we really need to think about is whether this is going to continue to marginalize innovative methods for STD control. So we're moving to antiretrovirals for these agents because it's HIV. Is this going to demote opportunities for combined HIV-STD control modalities for HIV prevention in this area? There really are not many options for topical PrEP that really speak to both HIV and common STD prevention. And I worry that with the shift of the field in this direction, STD may be left in the dust. And I think we have to be very cognizant, continue to insert ourselves, so to speak, in these trials and these considerations. And I think that's all I have to say. All right. Thank you.